My name is Clancy Imslund. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this evening. Glad to be back in Vancouver. Been here before a couple times. The first time I was here, it was kind of funny because I guess it must have been about 1989 or 1990. My daughter was here as a member of AA. She went to meetings. Her name was Kathy Clark. She was married to somebody named Clark. And she told me she kind of laughed in her meetings because she, in some couple of her meetings, there were a couple old fuddy-duddies saying, well, they're bringing that son of a bitch up from Los Angeles, thinks she knows it all. Or, might they just use a local speaker? I don't have to have a big deal like that. And she just said it. She just encouraged him. So I got up here, and she told me about this. I laughed. Then she was my date that night, so she sat up at the head table with me. She says, what's he doing up there? What's she doing up there with him? I said, that's his daughter. She said, well, I always liked him. So, yeah. I remember a pleasant trip. I was here another time, and I've been in Portland a few times. And I like it up here. I like this town because it reminds me, in many ways, of the little town I was raised in northern Wisconsin. I want to thank the young ladies who picked me up at the airport. Joanne and her husband, who circled in the airport just incessantly, waited for us to come out. And Mary, my hostess, who's been just a brick. You've been a good hostess, Mary. And the girls were kind enough to meet me at the airport. And I had this kind of sore back. And they looked solicitously as I carried my bags out, you know. One says, could we carry your bag? Yeah, they're way looking. If we'd have been alone, they'd have had those bags in a New York minute, I'll tell you. They'd have stuck with them. But we got here and everything is fine. I'm glad to be here. I've enjoyed the convention. I've heard all the speakers before. I was thinking tonight, though, there's kind of a funny thing. I've heard Patty and I've heard our Al-Anon Mary Pearl a number of times. And I didn't hear Adam. I shouldn't say this. God wants me to. I told Adam after the meeting that that's an excellent story he told about the invisible boat. And I told him that that was a story I created when I talked at the International Convention in Montreal, 1985. And what it deals with treatment centers. It's an illustration of treatment centers. And I want you to get a copy of that tape and listen to it and tell it right, Adam. I mean, it's none too good when it's done right. It is. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to, well, you give a good talk, Adam. It's a good talk. I don't know anybody ever told you that. I told Frank this. Some of you will know who this is, and most of you will not. But if you didn't have the mustache and didn't have the glasses, you were a dead ringer for a guy named Norm Alpie, who used to be a great speaker around the country. And he's dead now. He's been dead for about 10 years. But you look exactly like him. I thought it was a reincarnation. And you talk a little bit like him. And so watch your health. But I was thinking about the speakers, you know. I think I'm getting sicker. I'm getting so I identify more with Mary Pearl than I do with the alcoholics. I was listening to Patty last night. I never had syphilis, but I've had not a nasty little vengeful moods like she has. I've thought about killing my mate, but I haven't been strong enough to hold her head under the water. Every time I try that, she sends me to my room. Although I must say, I don't know how I got off on this, but it is possible if you're married to an Al-Anon to eventually, if you wear him down and establish your position in the house. Like my wife, I was telling her just yesterday morning. I said, you know, we bicker about this and fight about this sometimes, but after all, I'm the head of the household. I'm the man in the house. You're the wife in the Al-Anon. And I will make decisions for the house, and you must accept them. And I'm not going to do that laundry till I finish my scrubbing. About a week and a half in our meeting, we put out a little something called the poop sheet, which goes on the wall and gives all the events of the week. And you get that, don't you, Ron? Where's your Ron? Where are you, Ron? Yes, you get that, don't you? I said I'd mention his name. This way I've worked him in. How's it been over in Portland, Ron? Selling many pools over there? How's everything going? Okay. But we put in this, and I put in little bits of wisdom to share with our group if I can have it. And I put in one last week that I really am ashamed of because it's so pleasant to Al-Anon. It's just, yeah. But isn't this nice? Anyone can get into AA, but you have to know someone special to get into Al-Anon. If you're a diabetic, that'll slip you right into a coma. Just. One other thing I've noticed, I've been sitting right down here for all the speakers. I've enjoyed them all, and I've watched. It's kind of going downhill. They start off with three glasses of water. Then Adam had two glasses of water. I got one glass of water. Frank, you better bring a stone and suck it tomorrow. Oh, yeah, I should mention tomorrow morning speaker. I'm sure you'll all enjoy. He's a member of our group, and he's a good guy, and he's one of the. Yeah, I won't. Well, he may be a Marine, but he's not a recruiter. So if you'll just leave the young girls home tomorrow morning. But I'm glad to be here tonight because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm happy to be, and when I go to these conventions, it always reinforces why I'm, because I hear so many varying perceptions of the same things, and it makes me think about where I came from, a little town like this, as I say. And I grew up in a strong religious community, a Norwegian Lutheran community, which most, not very many around here. There's some up in Seattle, none in Los Angeles that I know of. And it's quite a strict church, but you know, it's a strict church. You're just a kid. It's the only church you know. They really only have, I've often said, they only really have two rules that seem to be there. You don't sin and you stay away from Catholics, which seems reasonable to this day if you want to go to heaven. Well, and you get rather strong directions about life forces, you know. I sometimes think, I don't know how the Norwegians ever continue to propagate because, you know, there's a kind of a mixed message you give to the youth. It's this. Sex is dirty. Sex is evil. Sex is bad. And you must save it for the one you love. Well, I've had a lot of sex with the one I love, I'll tell you. But I grew up I was a kind of a nervous, restless kid. I was a religious family, and everything was fine. And early in the Second World War, my parents had gotten divorced when I was 12, which was very shocking to me, because I had never seen a divorce at the age of 12 in this little town, and I certainly there'd never been one in our family ever. I just had never even heard of one hardly. And they got divorced, and I knew there must be something. I'd look back and see there was something sly about me that I always liked to view myself as an honest, clean-cut, tousled-haired, blue-eyed little tyke. But I was a kind of a little snot, I guess. Because I instinctively did the worst thing a child divorced parents could do without ever seeing a divorce. I began playing my parents against each other to avoid responsibility, to avoid getting out from under, of outsmarting everybody. And when I was 12, I'd been put ahead in school a year. I was a fast reader. I was a straight-A student. I was just a whiz-bang. My dad was a teacher in the school system. By the time I was 15, I'd outsmarted my mother and dad so much that I was flunking out of high school. And everybody felt bad, and I was always playing victim. God, I'm a victim. I play victim a lot. Did it all my life. And so one day I just didn't want to face the consequence of my action anymore. And this was the Second World War just started relatively recently. So I got my mother to, I told her I was going to go to Superior, Wisconsin and visit my aunt for a week in the summertime. And she thought it'd be a good idea. And she packed my little bag and gave me bus fare. And I took that money and hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea where the hell I was going. Just a dumb little pimply-faced little puke. And a guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis. He said, "Here's the road. I hope you make it." I said, "Sure, I'll make it." I stood outside in Minneapolis. The guy stops. "Where are you going, kid?" I said, "San Francisco." He said, "So am I. Hop in." And away we went. You know, I didn't think anything about it. He was in the Navy, going back to his ship, turned out. And he needed some lower companion to make him feel superior and keep him awake, I guess. But we would stop at night. There weren't motels then, but there were trailer courts. He'd get me a little bed. And I look back now, it seems almost shocked and ashamed to say this, but he didn't sexually abuse me. I felt so left out recently. Wasn't I attractive? And I must be the only kid in America that hasn't been, every talk I've heard for the last 5 years, and I was sexually abused. And I think, God damn it, I never had that. I'd have gone for it, probably. But anyway, he bought my meals, and, you know, I had nothing to compare it against. It just struck me. If you want to go hitchhiking, you tell them where you want to go, and they take you there. You know, that's all I know. We got to San Francisco, and he showed me that, he told me I was a little too young to be in the Marine Corps like I wanted to be, and I probably wouldn't be allowed to kill chaps. And he said, "Why don't you go into merchant marine? They're crying for men, and, you know, they need 16-year-old guys. They'll take 16-year-old guys, and go to the Coast Guard office." He told me how to get there. "And tell them you're in 16 and see if you get..." He kind of laughed. I went up there and I went in there and said, I'd like to be a merchant seaman. They gave me an application, filled it out, put 16. The guy said, "You're only 16 years old, kid. We'll need your parents' permission." So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission, brought it back. And they were just crying for men in those days, early in the Second World War. And they issued me seaman's papers right there. That's all there was to it. "Okay, here's people. We'll send you your final ones later." And they sent me to the National Maritime Union down Montgomery Street, showed me how to get there. And I went down there, like dumb little kid with a little bag. And they had me sign a waiver for my union dues. And the guy took me over to the Embarcadero and put me on a ship. And that afternoon, I was on the way to the South Pacific. And seemed fun to me. You know, remember going, standing on that ship. We just got on the ship, and the ship left. We went by. The guy said, "That's where... World's Fair was last year, Treasure Island." Went by Alcatraz. Under the Golden Gate. Then the damn ship just kept going. As I watched the earth slowly fade out of sight, I think I had an intuitive feeling that I'd made the first in an endless series of career mistakes. And they sent me to my forecastle, which was a sleeping room, and I was in there with three of the worst type of people that anybody can be with. These dumb kids can be with. They're called men. And they treated me coldly. I discovered why later, because I was the fourth member of their deck crew, and I was supposed to do one-fourth of the work on that watch. And they realized they were each going to be doing three and a third man's job for the rest of that trip. But I got to be kind of a dumb, a lot of places have dumb kids that have them sometimes in the military too, you know. You just use, as the days went by, I learned how to act dumber than usual. "Now, hey kid, go down to the engine room, tell them we need a left-handed wrench." "Kid, go up in the bridge, tell the captain we need some elbow grease." One day a guy said, "Here, have a drink of whiskey, you little kid." And that, I drew the line there, because I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. And Norwegian Lutherans don't drink whiskey. I promised my mother and grandmother I wouldn't, and I wouldn't do that. And I was about to tell this guy, "How dare you?" I just noticed he had black hair, obviously a Catholic. I'd never seen one close up, but I'd heard about it. The black hair is one tip off, and the sinfulness is the other. And, I was just about to tell him, "Take that bottle out of my face," when he said, "You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And I just told him, "God damn right." So I found out I'm a little weak under pressure, too. I took a drink of whiskey out of the first bottle I was close to ever, and I threw it up, and they laughed at me and sneered at me. I don't know any single thing to this day that is more hurtful to me than public humiliation when you're really hung out to dry. It's just people all laughing at you. They can't. I thought to myself later, if I'd had a gun, I'd have shot him easily. There was nothing I could do. I thought about it way later. There's one thing I might have done that would have got him, but I'm glad I didn't think of it because I would have been thrown overboard. Hey, buddy, lean over. Yeah? Take that. Give one in the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific, when nobody's looking, I'd sneak in that guy's sea bag and take a drink of whiskey at least once a day, and I'd throw it up and wipe it up so they wouldn't know. I was so desperate to be a part of. And I thought that'd make it. Of course, it wouldn't, but it seemed like it would. Remember, we were just coming into Pearl Harbor, and they were still digging up ships from Pearl Harbor, and it was the day before my 16th birthday, and they were looking, and I took a drink of this crap, and I remember that was the first time I'd ever stayed down. Then I couldn't breathe, I thought, why do people drink this? I can't drink this. Then all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. I realized that's why people drink whiskey. Makes you feel better. I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think any great breakthrough. It's like everything else when you're in teens. You learn things. I've always kind of envied these people who have insights. And they have great insights. You hear them from once in a while in AA. They say things like, when I held that drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience, with many flowers and fruits to be savored in the coming years until I left that garden to come to this wonderful program of recovery. I never do that. All I knew is if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's all I learned. I learned to smoke on that ship. Nobody I knew smoked, and I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. And finally smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day, every day for the next 40 years. And I'd still be smoking, except I noticed it's making me bald. Look around. You can see the smokers. I learned to swear in that ship. I learned to lust effectively. That's something I'd never done. Don't misunderstand me. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And on that ship, I learned you could actually do it with people if you could. And I learned a little. I wasn't quite so dumb when I got off that ship. And I got another ship, and later in the war, I went in the Navy when I was old enough. And by the time I knew a little bit, the end of the war, I was up in Naval Hospital at Pleasanton, California. And I got discharged out of there and went to. And while I was there, they were passed out a lot of tests because the war was ending. And I always been good on tests because I'm a reader. And I did very well in the test. And they gave me a high school equivalency from the Armed Forces Institute. I had no idea what it was even for. But I've thought about that many times since. That changed my life. If I hadn't taken that test or hadn't done well, I'd have gone back to Wisconsin after the war, and they'd have said, you have to start your junior year of high school again. And I wouldn't have done that in a million years. But instead, I went to college after the war. In fact, I was telling someone in Food Line tonight that last September, I was back at the University of Wisconsin where I was Master of Ceremonies for the 50th anniversary of the entering class of 1946. Which really was a raunchy class because all these veterans, the worst class in the history of the world, and every university all over the world, they weren't all so bad, but just strange. A lot of veterans coming out, some old guys who didn't know what to do. If they go to college, they could go to college on the GI Bill, and everybody did it. And you'd wind up in classes, an English class, there'd be some old ex-chief petty officer, about 35 years old, sitting there next to some little 17-year-old girl just out of the farm, You put out? and really a lot of campus romances went on, I'll tell you. I can tell you that personally. And I went to college. I got married in college, because that's what veterans did. And I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, and which is still to this day my favorite job. And then I discovered that I had not listened to the warnings that I should have listened to. this girl that I was going with in college, she had black hair. She was just out of high school. She was an innocent, sweet girl. She had black hair and black flashing eyes. And she just, I'd never seen anybody like that in the Lutheran church, you know. And she won my heart, and then she dropped the bombshell. I'm a Catholic. I thought I should have known it. It was too late now. So we got married against the wishes of my grandmother. Had the vapors for about 2 years over that. And then she started showing the signs of why you shouldn't marry Catholics. I mean, she was a good girl, but one thing they never tell little Lutheran boys, if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family, whether you are budgeted for one or plan on one. And I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just boom, boom, boom. I saw most of them last Saturday in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I just, each one of them, as I looked in their eyes, I thought, you broke my heart in that city, didn't you? You made me go to household finance in that city, didn't you? They've all got bad memories for me. But I love them. But so I had to get better jobs. I got into advertising, public relations. And all these years, I used the things I'd learned when I was a kid. I smoked, and I swore, and I lusted effectively, and I drank. And drinking always was, if you're kind of new, if anybody here's kind of new, let me tell you something. It probably sounds terrible in AA, but alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. I've never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Cities come and go. Jobs come and go. Husbands and wives come and go. But a few drinks when it's really working for you, that is a constant. That is a good thing. And I look back now and I see what alcohol does for people like me. At the time, I had no idea it was unusual. I thought it was just absolutely standard. Never thought a thing about it. But alcohol takes people like me who have a tendency of themselves to feel like they're never quite enough somehow. To feel like there's something missing inside of me and I have to disguise it. Because if people see me as I really am, they won't like me. But when I have a few drinks, I feel like I'm more than enough. Here I am, baby. What a nice feeling. That's not funny. This is the signal for coarse laughter. Takes a person like me who lives with a lot of fear. I disguise it. I've disguised fear all my life. Don't worry about me, Jack. But inside of me, there's a guy. Maybe they won't like me. When I have a few drinks, I become fearless many times. I fight cops. You know, I would never do that stuff when I'm drinking. Come on, son of a bitch. Come on, try me. You know. Takes a person like me who's. I'll jump off balconies and swimming pools. Haven't got a swimming pool? I'll jump on your lawn. Shit makes no difference to me. Takes a person like me that's so afraid of rejection, I'm almost afraid to ask my wife to dance sometimes just when she wants to say, no, not now. It's all different when I drink. The best example I know, I must have said it 1,000 times, but I don't know a better way to say it. It's happened to a lot of guys in this room, I can tell by looking at them. You know, it's sitting at night in a bar, having a few drinks, thinking how they're screwing you around down to work. The brown nosers are taking over and the men of integrity are being held back. As you have a few drinks, you suddenly notice a miracle slowly take place in front of your eyes. Some old beast gradually becomes beautiful. I might sidle over to such an old queen at closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. If she would say no, God, if I were sober, I'd just cut my wrists right there. When I've had a few drinks, I don't feel that way. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. Yeah. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler and sensitive and creative. And sometimes I drink too much and then people think I act bizarrely. But I have some friends of my family sent me to my first AA meeting when I was a young guy, 22. And they said, why don't you go to... They had no idea what it was. They just heard it was in this town and maybe they'll help you cut down a little bit. So I went, 1949. That's a long time ago. Most of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. I don't know, I guess AA was there, exactly it is now, but it must look to me like young people sometimes see AA now. You've been a bunch of old pukes in their 30s and 40s and gray-haired people. Some old fool saying, but it sounded to me like, I stayed drunk around the clock, night and day. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful. And of course you feel like saying, why should you tell your face, you old fool, you know? But I went to AA long enough to discover what AA is. AA is for people whose problem is drinking. And when they stop drinking, they seem to feel better. And I left and I went back another time in another city. And the next few years I went to AA from time to time when the heat was on for my drinking. But I always really knew drinking was not the problem. It was much more complex than that. So I spent several $1,000 in psychoanalysis to get to the root of my problems. Well, they say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I loved it. I loved it. I always felt better in psychoanalysis. And I never could understand why. I remember a few years ago thinking, why did I feel good in psychoanalysis? What was so good about that? Why did I spend money I didn't really have and go distances to go to see a psychiatrist? That you never get any good news in psychoanalysis. You just find out how you've been screwed in different ways that you don't remember. You know, how you've been hurt. I said, look, and recently, in the last few years, I've come upon the reason why I realized why I went to psychoanalysis and why many people go to these modern therapies, these adult child therapies and the inner child therapies, because they make you feel better. Now, how do they make you feel better? Well, it's quite simple, I think, in my opinion. Probably the worst single emotion I've had in my life, the long-term emotion, is guilt, deep-seated guilt. Not only of the things I've done, but the things I should have done or didn't do or wasn't there to do and so on. And they just eat you up. And psychoanalysis helped me overcome guilt. Now, what's wrong with that? That's the same thing these modern therapies do. They overcome guilt. Now, how do they do this? By a very simple procedure. They convince the patient that he or she is and has always been a victim. It is not your fault. It is their fault. They did not nurture me. They did not love me. They did not treat me well. And therefore, it is not my fault. I've been made this way. However I act, it's just I've been programmed this way. So as a result of that, I no longer have the guilt for these things. They should have the guilt. All of our speakers today, this weekend, have talked about their parents and their relationship to their parents. And we all can find an easy way on that one. Now, what's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. Gets rid of guilt. Except for one little thing you discover here. There are no free lunches in life, apparently. And whenever you get something that does something for you, you pay a little tab. And in this one, to get rid of guilt, it's kind of a... There are three little tabs. You don't notice them when you got them, but you notice can see them in retrospect. And the three little tabs are these. One, whether you intend to or not, to be a victim, you must sustain and enhance feelings of resentment. Because little by little, you get to resent those people who did this to you or failed to do what they should have done. And the situations where they should have nurtured you and how they hurt you and abused you. When you go to these therapies where they talk about their parents a lot, you find no laughter like you find in AA. You find no jolliness. You find people sitting around intensely living in pain, reliving it and reliving it and reliving it. The second little price tag you pay is whether you intend to or not. You must accept the fact that you are terminally different. I never really understood that concept until I heard one of their gurus once upon a time. I went to one of their meetings for the fun of it, and he said, "We are like trees. When we were saplings, we were hurt and damaged and scarred deeply within us. We continued to grow. We are now apparently full-grown trees. But inside of us, we will always be permanently scarred. We will never be screwed again." And you've got to be very careful about that. That one thing A does for you, you take responsibility for your own life. And then you can be a man or a woman instead of a child. But I went to all these therapies, I read books, and all these years I drank, and sometimes I drank too much. And what I had is a series of ups and downs. I had some successes, then I'd get drunk or emotional and lose my job and go to a new town and have a new resume and get going and bring my wife in and have a baby and then blow up in that town, go to the next town. And I asked, in fact, just one of these towns I'm really going to make it. I almost made it this close time after time. Almost made it big in Dallas, almost made it big in a lot of places. And one day I went down and started to come back up, and I didn't come back up. And I couldn't believe it. What happened? All of a sudden, I'm sure I look back and see it coming for years, but at the moment, just out of nowhere, I just can't come back up. And I found myself in this position that a man of my background and intelligence and ability cannot be in. Two big guys were throwing me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles and said, "And stay out of here, bum." And I tried to explain to them, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And unfortunately, about 3 weeks before that, I'd had my front teeth kicked out of the Phoenix Jail. I remember that was one of the few mornings I was going through Phoenix on the run out of Texas because they wanted to put me back in the nut house. And I got in a beef on the street, turned out to be a plainclothesman. They just threw me in jail overnight to cool me off. And I was laying on the floor sleeping. And I got in the middle of the night, had to vomit. And I went to the can and vomit. Turned out I missed. It wasn't the can. It was the guy's bed. And he was cross. He came back and found it, me sleeping next to it. And he just, "God damn you." And he kicked my front teeth out. Now, it was one morning. I was really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. Because almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, "This son of a bitch is overreacting." But I didn't want to say anything and cause trouble. But I stood outside of the midnight mission on the corner of 4th. I didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. I didn't have friends there. And I stood there, and it was a cold, rainy morning. Like this morning, or like this afternoon, kind of only a cold, drizzly rain. And I stood there and I thought, "This can't be happening to me." And if some old guy would come over to me that morning and said, "You know, Slim, you're dying. You're down near 100 pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. You were a boy genius," everybody said. "And now you can't get a job washing dishes. You've lost your home. You've lost your career. You've lost your clothing even. You lost that somewhere between Texas and here. I have no idea where your clothing is. All you got left is what you got on you. And that's wet and you're sick. You're an only child and your mother's not allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather is tired of watching you build her hopes up one more time and then crush them again. He'd rather have her think you're dead than watch it, have her heart broken again. Now look at you. And you've been going to AA now almost 10 years. Off and on. Why don't you, for Christ's sake, just go to AA and say you're an alcoholic and do the things and get out of it?" If some guy had said that to me, if I were in a mood to be honest, and by that time I wasn't honest, I would say whatever needed to be said to get me through anything. That's one of the great marks of people like me, and I see him every day today. But if I were in some strange phenomenon of being honest, I'd have had to say to him, "But you don't understand. AA is not designed for people like me. I'm not really an alcoholic. I have no question there's something terribly wrong with me. I've known it since I was a boy, and I spent my life disguising it. But I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. It'd make my life much more simple." And if he said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic, I wouldn't have been able to do that because I wouldn't have had the dispassion to be able to stand back and examine myself and evaluate myself. So I probably would have done what people like me do, frighten people when they get in trouble. They take refuge behind bluster. They say things like, oh, get out of my face. Screw you. Because I wouldn't have known the real answer. I know the real answer now because I've known about it for a lot of years. I've seen it myself and many others. And the answer is quite simple. I've been going to AA for years around the country, off and on, here and there. And I knew what alcoholics. I knew what an alcoholic was, and I'm not that. That's all. It's just that simple. Which begs the question, well, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody here knows what an alcoholic is. The newcomers, Al-Anons, everybody knows what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is a person who, one of those people, when they drink too much, and they don't handle it well, and their lives eventually get screwed up, and their emotions get painful, and they get driven to some place like AA, and AA guys sober them up, and they clean up their act, and they live comfortably after that, more comfortably. And I know that's true, because I've heard many, many people tell that story all over the country, my drinking days. And I believed them. I believed them. I have never doubted from my first meeting that AA works. I'll tell you something else. I have never known a long-term drinker of any kind who didn't believe that AA works. I've never known a long-term slipper in AA, still drunk on the straight, who doesn't believe AA works. Everybody that I know believes AA works. But there's just one other little caveat that comes at the end of that that's said kind of softly. People sometimes don't hear it, but we all know the feeling. AA works, no question about it. But not for cases like mine. Works for them, no question about it. It doesn't work for cases like mine, because I'm not really an alcoholic. There's something terribly wrong with me, but I'm not really an alcoholic. But no old man came over and talked to me that morning. I just stood in the rain and sick, and I knew I had to get off that street corner somehow. And I remembered a guy when I'd been knocking around, looking around Los Angeles a week before, drunk, and some guy had taken me to an AA club. And I remember it was the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, and I'll go there and get off the street so I won't get arrested or something. And I walked out there, I found out how to go there. A guy showed me how to go up to Hill Street and over to Wilshire and out. And I counted that later in my car. It was 72 blocks. That's long blocks in rain and sick and desperate. Remember a woman in New York one time said to me, how could you walk all those blocks when you were sick and desperate? It's hard to explain. That's the only time you can. You couldn't do it any other time. You have to be really sick and desperate. Then you could do almost anything because you got to survive. And I walked in this damn club, and as soon as I got there, I realized, oh, it all came back to me. I'd been in there, and I denounced them all and told them how lucky they were to be stupid. And Jesus Christ. They weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. It was just hideous. And not only was it an AA club, but it was full of AA fanatics. I don't know any single thing that's more distressing to an intelligent slipper than to be surrounded by these inane goddamn AA fanatics and their continual hounding with your slogans and crap. Yeah. For example, I'll tell you something about AA fanatics. Now, I'm not a mooch. I have never been a mooch. Except when I've had to be. But I'm like a lion. I don't kill for sport. I just kill for food. But, you know, you have to tell people how they can help you so they don't know. These alcoholics, they mean well, but they're dumb. And you have to tell them that. Tell them little things like, I've never been to your wonderful program, but I've heard so much about it. No. Drinking has ruined my life, and I've come here for help. I have no place to stay, and I have no food, and I have wet clothes. I have no place to turn. If I just had some place to stay, and perhaps some food, and perhaps a few dollars, I think perhaps I could really work this wonderful program and find a new life. Now, that's a pretty clear-cut hint. You know what AA fanatics say? They say things like, go to a lot of meetings. Work the steps, it'll all work out. And of course the answer to that is, oh gee, sir, you're number one with me. And I hung around that club, and that night they had a meeting. I ate about 4 pounds of cake and listened to their dismal goddamn stories. And club closed. I had no place to go. They said, well, the guy said, there's an old abandoned Mercury down there, halfway down the parking lot. Some tall grass around it's growing up around it. Joe Quinn left it here last July. Go sleep in that. Thanks a lot. I slept in that damn old abandoned car that night. I got up the next morning and I went to the club. It was Sunday morning. I ate about 4 pounds of cake and listened to their drivel. And this went on for several days. I was living on cake and listening to their crap. And I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is just hell for screwing Catholics. Maybe this. And I had no idea then, or a long time thereafter, that would be my sobriety date. Because I didn't intend for it to be. Didn't want it to be. I don't suppose anybody ever slipped as long as I have, who now stayed sober as long as I have, going on 39 years since I walked off Skid Row, that doesn't look back and think, what was different this time? What was different? What made the difference? You know, not only for my own information, but I'd like to share it. Because people refer to this day, refer long-term slippers to me as though I got some magic answer for them. I used to think I could just talk them into long-time sobriety, but I've come to realize I can't. But I have been able to help some people, but I can't do that. It's a strange thing. I look back and think, what was different this time? You know, you'd think a long-term slipper would be able to help a long-term slipper, but it's to talk about into it, and you can guide them into it a little bit. But it's very similar to something happened to me a few years ago in my backyard, my driveway. I was trying to teach two of my grandsons to ride a bike, Joe and John Nutman. And we were having a terrible time. They kept falling off, and Joe got a bloody nose, and John scratched his arm, and they're, we don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa. Said, yes, you do. You just don't know it. At the end of the day, they couldn't ride a bicycle. I just felt so terrible, and everybody looked at me. What did you do to John and Joe? And we tried again a few days later, and God, it's just terrible. Well, but those little rats eventually did something that most of the people in this room have done, and there isn't a person in the world can describe how you did it. So I suddenly got the sense of balance. And when you get that, you can ride a bicycle for the rest of your life. You can ride motorcycles, whatever you want. But you cannot convey that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. Everybody's got to get on their own bicycle and fall off. And it's much more complex, but it's the same thing with this illness of alcoholism. All we can do is put you on the bike. And give you what tips we can. But I look back and think, what was different this time? That I guess I really wanted to stop drinking this time. That's it. There was a deep-seated yearning. Not at all. The one time I had ever really tried to stop drinking, I stopped for the best possible reason. Because I had another one of my overnight stays in jail. Never any big deal. I'm not a big convict. I was in jail a lot overnight because I had a smart mouth. And that morning they had to come down and tell me my son died while I was in jail the night before. And they couldn't find me. And I felt, oh God, I felt so terrible. Because I had a bunch of little girls and this little boy. And I loved the little girls, but he was the apple of my eye in a sense. And I felt so bad. I really almost committed suicide. I just couldn't stand it. And then they get together for the funeral, and nobody says a word about it, but you just feel all the eyes on you, just saying, you dirty son of a bitch. Yeah. But nobody, everybody's fine. And when we put his casket in a mausoleum up the cold climates, you don't put him in the ground in the wintertime. You put him in a vault, and then in the summertime when it's thawed, you make a grave. I put my hand in his little casket. Nobody's around. I said, John Imslin, this will never happen to another child in this family. I swear to you. And so I'm down in Texas to work, and I went down there as I usually did ahead of my family, and I was doing all right, and I liked it. I got away from everything. I was drinking a little bit, and everything was fine. I was watching my drinking. I liked my job, and my family and children came in, and as usual, when they joined me, the pressure was on a little bit more, so I'd drink a little bit more. I didn't intend to, but just a little more pressure. And one day I started drinking a little too much, and it had to be pointed out to me that, you remember now, Clancy, don't wind up like you did before. You'll kill yourself. And I said, that's right. Thank you for calling my attention. And I went on the wagon right then. I did it for my son, John, and I went on the wagon. I didn't drink anymore. I went to a few A meetings, but I'd been going to A meetings for years by this time, and I knew all the things I was going to say and all the slogans, and that's very nice, but that's not my problem. I went to a psychiatrist for a while, and I read some books. And I really had a great sense of, like you do, a great sense of something. Because I was doing this for my son, John. I said, John, I'm staying sober for you, son. But I had no idea that, because the nature of my illness, all that does is postpone it. That's all. It just postpones it. And pretty soon, the emotions start coming back. The irritability, and the crossness, and the feeling uncomfortable. And the job I used to like, I didn't like it much anymore. I didn't like the people. I didn't like the crapheads. I didn't like the neighborhood. I didn't like Texas. The wind blew. And just my own kids who I was doing it for. You know, Mary, go to your room. You make too much noise. Stop it. I'm sorry. Daddy's sorry. Just that it doesn't feel good. Just let me. Yeah, it's just I needed a drink so bad that I couldn't stand it. But if you've taken a vow on your son's casket, you can't drink. So what do you do now? You can't drink and you can't stay sober. Now what? Well, one day my wife took the kids to church, to Mass, and I just pulled the car in the garage and closed the door and hooked up a hose and exhaust pipe and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what else to do. And some neighbor was watching us and noticed I didn't come out and heard the motor running, walked over there and saw me slumped across the wheel, apparently newly dead, and pulled me out and beat my chest. They rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and worked on me and determined I was mentally ill and moved me to a severe locked ward and examined me some more and determined I was had severe mental illness and committed me for an indefinite but eventually probably permanent commitment to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. You think that's funny? I mean, this is a sad story. This goof talking tomorrow morning. Oh. Not as much fun as bayoneting old widows, but it's something, you know. But I went to that nut house, boy, and I'll tell you, I was there about 2 weeks and I started to feel better. I thought, God, I got to get out of here. This is terrible. And I escaped, and they had said it was an escape-proof hospital, but not for the old Claire Fox, it isn't. And I got over the fence, and I made my move, and it is an escape-proof hospital. I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but they can see you running for 3 days out there. And somebody who sounds a lot like Mary Pearl says, well, there goes that little Yankee son of a bitch now. And my reward for that was 3 series, which is 36, electric shock treatments. And once you have those, you never run much for a long time. You just, what's your name, boy? I don't know. Check the disc. Property of State of Texas. Does that sound right? Well, the next year, I was thinking, I got to get out of here one of these years, you know. This is going to start to look bad on my resume, you know, just And a little of my sense had come back off those shock treatments, and they did something for me that was just a stroke of good fortune. They put in the first experimental alcoholic ward in the state of Texas in the Big Spring Hospital that spring. And I had enough sense back to come back and, AA, I know how to hustle those silly bastards. And that's the only way I had to get out. And I hustled, got the counselor, and eventually I got moved to the alcoholic ward from the psychiatric ward. And eventually I pretended to be an alcoholic and played all their little games. And eventually I was released as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's not a solution for me. Stop drinking puts me in the nut house or puts me in a car with the exhaust pipe on. That's all. I've often thought I'd like to go back sometime and find that doctor who made the diagnosis of me as a schizophrenic, a dual personality. I'd like to, he must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good, you know. You quack diagnosing me as a dual personality. Christ, if I had got my personalities down to 2, I'd have made it. You know. My problem has always been this group that appears in my head like it appears in these other people's heads. You know, just get out of here. Don't think we can. I'm not sure. What do you think? I don't know. I used to hear people in AA say things like, I'm not sure A is enough for me. I may need group therapy. Not me. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about drinking. Drinking reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice.
Why don't you quit your job and punch that bastard in the face?
Okay. Boom. No, I didn't want to stop drinking. I never have wanted to stop drinking. I'm trying to find a way to control it, but never to stop, because stopping to me is suicide. I look back and I think, of all the, you know, it's a strange thing, of all the emotions I've ever had, and I've had a lot of emotions, all the emotions you've had. You know, I used to think my emotions were unique unto me, but they're not. I've worked with alcoholics for a lot of years, and I've never found a new emotion. That I, you know, they talk about alcoholic emotions. Alcoholic emotions are the same emotions Pharaoh had. Only they might be a little, we might handle them immaturely, but they're same emotions, you know. And, but these emotions are all unique unto me, and they're different unto me, and I cope with them. And it's just, I'm always trying to find a way to overcome them. That's interesting inside, you know. Just in passing, most human beings have emotions, and they have intellect, the power of the human will to control. And they use this power of the mind to control emotions, to keep behavior right. In certain neurotic or intense or immature emotions, strong emotions, sometimes there's a standoff. And when there's a continuing standoff between the power of the mind and the emotions will always win. Because eventually the mind gets tired and goes, takes a walk or something. And we, therefore, people like me have spent much of my life, I'm sure you have too, reading, discovering, learning, trying to find ways to strengthen that mind to hold those damn emotions in check. But you matter, sooner or later, they get to be, well, emotions win again. And you just wonder, I'm going to be able to do this if I read things. And that's the power of the human mind, the power of the human will. That's what we say. That doesn't work, but it takes a while to understand that. That's willpower. We always call it willpower, the power of the human mind to control. And you go to AA, and AA says, oh, just ignore all those intellectual things. You'll be all right. And you're crazy. I can't even hold them in power now. But it turns out AA has techniques that is absolutely, you don't accept in retrospect. You can't believe it when you're new because it seems so stupid. You know how AA overcomes that? It does not strengthen your will at all. It reduces the pressure on the emotions. Does the same thing only from the other end. And eventually, little by little, your mind is most of the time in control of your emotions. And it seems incredible. But the question is, how do you get to that point? How do you get to that point? Of all the emotions I've had, I suppose the worst one, I suppose, is depression. Somewhere between depression and desperation. And it's such a feeling, I haven't got a name for it. But it's, I know it has in its past put me in bed with the covers over my head for days sometimes. Just absolutely wiped out. And it's, there's been one help for it sometimes. I drink. And if the drinking doesn't help, I run away. Now, there's nothing wrong with a 15-year-old kid running away, but when you're the father and husband, you shouldn't run away. But I've had to run away and go to a new town, get a job, and bring him in there. Just because it's suicide for me. And these emotions are just eat me up. And I can't deal with them. I look back and I think probably one of the most fortunate things in my life is I was thrown amongst those damn fanatics. I wouldn't call them fanatics tonight. Tonight I would describe them as AA winners. That's what they tell you if you're new. They say, stick with the winners. Of course, the question is, who are the winners? The people who've been sober the longest? Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes old-timers, I wouldn't even ask them for advice to get to a corner because they're so negative. They just see how little they can get by with doing, and they just don't feel comfortable. I'll tell you who the winners are as far as I can tell. They are the people who are currently sitting in the seats and trying in their stupid, dumb little ways to try to find what to do and trying to be of some kind of, do what AA says and try to simulate interest in others and do take little actions and, as I said earlier, make the coffee at 5 o'clock in the morning and do all the dumb little things and do what their sponsor says. They don't even know it, but they are trying to serve God and man. They're trying to show love and service, although they don't even know it. But they are the AA winners. They are also called activists. Get with the activists, the people who are trying to find out what they have to do. That's why they also say stay away from the losers. Well, who are the losers? Hard to tell those, because sometimes they're very gregarious. Sometimes they're very charismatic. Boy, I would like to be with those people. I'll tell you how you spot losers. Stay away from people who say, oh, you don't have to do all that stuff. You don't have to do those things. They're just fanatics, for Christ's sake. You don't have to do those things, because they'll kill you. They will kill you. Over the years, I've done a lot of terrible things. When I came to AI, I remember telling a guy, I've broken all 10 commandments. There's no chance for me. A few years later, I looked back and I realized I haven't broken all 10 commandments. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Well, it's a beachhead. But I've tried to go back and make amends. People have talked this weekend about making amends, and rightfully so, one of the most important steps. That's where the promises are when you read about the amends. And I've gone back and made amends to a lot of people. But the worst thing I can think of that I can never make an amend for directly is that whenever I was around AA and hung around a while being cute and slick, whenever I left, I always tried to take one or two with me to drink with me. Some other idiot who maybe, and I'm sure some of them are dead as a result of my cuteness. I wish I could go back and say, sorry, but you can't. So what you got to do is just keep week after week looking for new people and sticking out that hand. Say, hang in, kid, you know. But I look back and the great thing about the fanatics, which I call winners, is they get you doing things that you would not ordinarily do left to your own devices. I mean, they're doing things together, and if you're in the middle, you're like a... I'm having a senior moment. What are these animals that change colors? I can't think of the word. Huh? Chameleon. Keep your nose out of my business. I know that. But people like us are like chameleons. That's how they stick with the winners, because you'll eventually blend in any background you're with sooner or later. And you get to the thing. I remember I'd hang around that club. I was living there in the band. Cars that a few weeks went by and I was still there, and I'd be sitting thinking things like, God, I'll never see my kids again. I wasn't a very good father, but I loved them in the abstract, and I wish I could see with them, and I'll never be with them, and I'll never see anything again. What's the sense of even trying? Come on, Clancy, time to go to the meeting. Hop in the car. I'd be sitting thinking, I'll never have a career again. God, I had it, boy. I was good, but I'm no good now. I'm nothing. Just come on, we're going to help Fred move his furniture. Oh, sure.